Join culture creator Ramel Wallace, museum CEO Micah Parzon, philanthropist Erwin Jacobs, and urban agriculturist Diane Moss on Season 2 of Stop and Talk, a podcast about the future of the San Diego region. How can we create a vibrant region that celebrates our cultural richness and economic strength? Find out and hear other San Diego experts on Stop and Talk. Discover seasons 1 and 2 now at stopandtalkpodcast.com. That's stopandtalkpodcast.com. Are you passionate about resolving conflicts and making positive impact in the world? Then USD's Conflict Management and Resolution Master's Program may be for you. Learn to address conflicts at all levels, from personal disputes to global crises. Join the Kroc School's dedicated community fostering peace and understanding while you acquire practical skills to navigate diverse settings. Apply now and be the change you want to see in the world. Visit sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD. That's sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD.
I heard you on the phone. I LOL'd when you were like, I'm looking at this. I'm not seeing what I need, which is the cost.
Yeah, yeah. I was like, get it. Get it, Lisa.
Welcome to the Voice of San Diego podcast in partnership with News Radio 600 COGO. I'm Andrea Lopez Villafana, managing editor at Voice of San Diego, and I'm joined this week by reporter Jacob McWinney.
Howdy.
And senior investigative reporter Will Huntsbury.
Hello, Andrea.
What's up, Will?
Yo.
Coming up on the show this week, Will has an epic story of one Navy service member who was based in San Diego. She struggled for a long time with her mental health, but the Navy, which is struggling itself to pull in new recruits and retain members, failed to meet one of their core responsibilities, to keep its members safe. He'll share that story. And we'll bring in reporter Lisa Halverstadt. She dug into some of the most expensive affordable housing projects in San Diego. Now she'll explain why they cost so much. Plus, a big shelter announcement from Mayor Todd Gloria. We've got all that and more coming at you this week. Stay with us.
But first, our generous supporters gave us a big boost during our spring campaign. We raised about $90,000 and brought on 100 new members. We appreciate you all. And if you're sad the campaign passed you by, don't be. You can always give to support this show and our journalism. Donate at vosd.org/give. That's vosd.org/give.
Jacob, I've been your editor for a while now. Feels like.
Ooh, is a burn coming?
Fun times.
I know, I'm getting a little sweaty.
Time goes by fast when you're having fun. Yes. I can't remember how long I've been here or you've been here. But ever since you've been reporting on education, there's one thing that I've slowly watched you stress about super intensely.
Yes.
And that is chronic absenteeism.
Yeah. And you know,
in what is that? What's this? What are these jargons? I wouldn't know what that means.
So after you
stopped being education reporter.
Yeah. After you stopped being the education reporter, did they just like use the Men in Black?
All jargon from my brain.
Yeah. They used the Men in Black memory eraser on you.
It was awesome.
That's what we do.
Yeah. Well, in my defense, I think everybody should be freaking out about chronic absenteeism, whether you're a parent or an educator or not. It's a huge deal. Basically, what it is when a kid misses at least 10% of days in a school year.
That's right.
Yeah. Nice.
It's all coming back to him now.
Yeah, yeah. I like when Will plays the heel. That's fun. You know, there are lots of reasons to freak out about it. Kids just can't learn if they're not in class. Mm-hmm. And with all of the learning loss that occurred over the pandemic, kids really need to be learning. And besides that, as I've said many times, it's kind of this educational double whammy where not only does it affect kids, but it affects districts who get funded based on attendance. So it's It's a big deal.
Yeah. And others thought it was a big deal this week, too. I mean, you've been stressing out about it for a while, but now the New York Times.
Yeah. They're stressing.
Yeah. It's come in.
And it even got the daily treatment, which is quite gratifying to see. I mean, it's not their first piece on chronic absenteeism, but it's like their first big flagship piece, I feel like.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an okay podcast that listeners should check out if they have some extra time.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe not as popular as ours, but you know.
Exactly.
You know.
It's okay.
It's fine.
Once you've listened to the Voice of San Diego podcast episode and you're like, I still want to know a little more.
Go to the daily.
Go to the daily.
It's a very interesting podcast. I really appreciate the way that they tell stories. So one of the things that was interesting about this New York Times reporting was how much it isolated kind of this, what I've been referring to as the vibe shift of attendance. I've reported on it myself, but it wasn't something that I kind of centralized as much as the New York Times did. And basically what I mean by vibe shift is that it seems that for a lot of parents, a lot of kids, their relationship to school has just kind of been altered in this way that may just always be there now. Mm-hmm. Some parents view it as more optional. And so if a kid is having a hard time, maybe they're more willing to keep them home to have a mental health day. If a kid is sick, they're more willing to keep them home to not potentially spread things. Or
if they're just having a weird day even more now, right?
You
know what I mean? We've always kept kids home for sickness, but it seems like the vibe shift is like maybe going beyond that. Like, you know, you always knew rich kids who would miss a week to go skiing and stuff. And I don't think it's all about that, but the more of that optional mentality.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's the big thing. You know, there is just... The routine of school is a little bit broken.
Yeah,
you know,
the vibe's different.
The vibe has shifted, and you never want the vibe to shift on you. That's a really bad thing.
Not when it costs you money if you're a school district, or it's learning. Your fed kids reading.
I mean, just in general, dude, the vibe is all powerful. You never
want the vibe to shift if it's bad. Then I'm hoping for a vibe shift.
Sure, but vibes very rarely shift in a good way.
But you pointed out in your learning curve that vibe has been around usually for the younger grades, right?
Like
people who, you know, have their kids in kindergarten, like, how important is kindergarten? Like,
totally,
I got a lot of chores to do, or, you know, we're going to go to the zoo today.
There's long been this, you know, sort of assumption that early grades, particularly kindergarten, like you said, are optional, right? I think a lot of parents think, oh, my kid's just going to be playing with blocks or like drawing with crayons or singing a song, and that's just not how kindergarten is anymore. It's become a lot more academic, it's become a lot more rigorous, and missing class in those early years can really set kids up to fall behind quickly. And oftentimes, as researchers have told me, if you fall behind early, it's really, really hard to catch up, because if you enter first, second, third grade without the sort of foundational knowledge, whether that's reading or, you know, rudimentary arithmetic, math, then you know, you're really not in a place to succeed. So this kind of more optional, more laissez-faire approach to attendance bleeding up into later grades is just...
Yeah. It's like a compounding effect, right? Because if you miss one lesson and that puts you down 1 point, let's say, but then you miss more and more, and you're like losing more each time you miss more almost.
Yes.
There's like a real snowballing.
Well, and that's not even to bring into the, that's not even to mention that when kids are missing a lot of school, it doesn't just affect those kids. It affects everybody in the classroom, right? Mm-hmm. Let's say, you know, Mr. Huntsberry is teaching third grade English and half of his kids have been missing school regularly. What does he now have to do? He has to go and pay attention to all those kids who are missing school and potentially
catch them up.
Yeah, and catch them up and potentially not pay enough attention to the other kids in the classroom. And so it's not just about a kid who's missing school. It's about the whole learning experience. And these sorts of domino effects are one thing that I think we all should be kind of wringing our hands about.
The vibe has shifted.
The vibe has shifted, and we got to unshift that vibe. I don't know how.
Right. We call in a shaman. I mean,
yeah, we need some like
push a vibe back in place.
We need some like educational sage to, you know, actually don't do that. There's a lot of illegal sage poaching.
Thank you for that shout out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Jacob gets into the New York Times piece and chronic absenteeism in his latest learning curve. You can read that at VOSD.org/Jacob. And that's Jacob with a K. We're joined in the studio now by Lisa Halverstadt, Senior Investigative Reporter at Voice. Hey, Lisa.
Hello.
So we were already planning on bringing you into the studio this week to talk about your new story, but in classic Lisa fashion, you also have some breaking news for us.
Classic. It's been a busy
day. She's on top of everything. That's what I mean, you know? She, like, knows everything.
Yeah.
Oh, I'll take that. I'll just take it.
So what's going on? What happened today, which is Thursday when we're recording?
Yes. So I started my Thursday at a warehouse.
Fun.
At Kettner Boulevard and Vine Street in Middletown, which is really close to downtown and Little Italy.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of that road that it's off the Sassafras exit. If you're driving down to head to the airport, you'll pass this warehouse.
Near where the brewery thing is that looks like a church, kind of that brick building with the spire.
So, yeah. It's been a while since I've made the drive from
it's
this
route. It's not an area that you like to think of.
It's yeah,
like
it's not non-area. Really an area that you,
you know it if you know
I go
it.
A different route now to the airport, so it's not really the way that I get there. But I will say like a lot of people take this particular route to the airport. And so basically there's this old warehouse, that has been sitting vacant for a few years now. And I was there because, Mayor Todd Gloria announced today that he wants to use this site as a 1,000 bed shelter for homeless people.
1,000 beds?
1,000 beds. And he sees this as, you know, a big potential game changer, you know, a lot more shelter beds, a net addition. I know Will's done a bunch of reporting on is there really an addition or not when we were talking about shelter bed ads in the past. He's proposing a 35-year lease for this facility. And I've got some, at least at the moment, it's fresh off the press. I've been pressing for more details on, like, what is this going to cost? Because at the press conference this morning, they didn't give any numbers. But I'm hearing that Gloria's office thinks that it would need to spend about $30 million a year on services there, $1.9 million a year on lease payments, that they would be, you know, making the payments monthly. So that's the annual total, $1.9 million. And that they'll probably be asking the city council to approve up to $18 million in upgrades for this warehouse. Now, I had a chance to walk around in the warehouse.
What kind of warehouse?
It's interesting. It used to be a print shop. Mm. It's on the ground floor, there's a big open space that the city's thinking that they could probably put hundreds of beds in this open space. And they're thinking there are a couple other levels. It's kind of a unique space because there's a different grade on Kettner versus I think it's California that's right behind it. And so it kind of creates a situation where there's three different levels of this building, which is interesting. But they're thinking 108 beds on the second level, and then that they might on the third level, sort of, it's kind of weird to call it the third level, but on the third level, they could have beds for families. Still much to be determined about this. I know the city council is going to have a lot of questions about the plan. You know, this is a move toward another congregate shelter. And there have been some folks arguing the city should be moving away from that. Of course, Mayor Gloria and also city council member Stephen Whitburn, who was there speaking, they argued that this is actually in keeping with some of the strategies to try to diversify their shelter offerings because, you know, they want to have a lot more beds. They've been opening different types of shelter options like the safe sleeping sites. They also have a non-congregate shelter for seniors, for example. I also think there are going to be a lot of questions about the building itself, given some of the past deals that I've written about.
Our little like antennas.
Indoor skydiving center. And I could see Will's just like squirming in his seat. He's thinking about these real estate deals.
Well, especially given.
Did they check the building for asbestos, though?
Exactly.
So interestingly, I was asking about this, of course, because you've got to. I mean, reporting on 101 Ash, you're always going to ask about asbestos.
Right. 101 Ash being the empty building right next to our building that the city bought and was supposed to be housing workers, but has literally just sat empty as the city paid for it. So now we've bought another piece of warehouse, and this time they're sure it's habitable.
Well, so I want to be clear, it hasn't been bought.
Oh, okay.
And they still, this is the thing, they want to lease it, but they're going to need to get through the city council. So the city council is going to have to review this. And we're looking at a really tough budget year. So, you know, there are going to be a lot of questions about how they pay for this. Gloria said today he thinks the city's general fund and various grants that it gets for homelessness projects and help from philanthropists should do the trick. But, you know, it's going to be pretty tight. On the question about asbestos, because we've got to cover that for the podcast listeners. So what I was told is that a prior person that wanted to buy the property but didn't actually, you know, get to the finish line on that, had proceeded with some work, I guess, to put sprinklers in and also do some asbestos abatement. I have said, and will definitely say for the record, I really would like to see those records, guys. Pretty please, can I get those records? So I'm still waiting for those. But apparently, this is something that they have thought of and they've been asking a lot of questions about.
Well, one point real quick that I always think about, and I know Lisa knows this too, an interesting fact is that East Coast cities have a lot more shelter, or a considerable amount more shelter, than West Coast cities. And so, you know, in some ways, adding 1,000 beds, you know, it definitely, some people are probably not going to like it. You know, I mean, I've seen the layout, like the beds are packed together like little sardines on one of those levels. And there is something about that that sits weird, but it's also very weird that, like, why do we have so many less shelter beds than East Coast cities, you know?
Mm-hmm. Hey, well, at least this place, looking at these layouts, it looks like there's a basketball hoop so people can get hooping.
Yeah, no, that's exciting. That's exciting. We got some ball will be happening.
So I think that that's actually, if there's that, which of the levels is that? So on some of the parking areas, if you look on like the Google Maps and get the street view, you can mm-hmm. see that there's some what looks to be basketball mm-hmm. amenities. I have to say I didn't see any when I was walking around. I didn't take a really close look at that top parking lot, but so didn't see any hoops.
RIP for the print shop, by the way. But
yeah.
Looking at this, it is also just striking how many amenities there are here, right? There's dozens of showers and restrooms on these sort of layouts.
What are you reading, Jacob?
These are some layouts that were presented at the press conference.
Is there like a Chick-fil-A?
No, but there is a 5,000 square foot kitchen.
Okay.
Smoking area,
you were
pet
gonna
area.
Say Chick-fil-A.
No. Dozens of showers and restrooms, workstations and offices and storage rooms and outdoor dining areas. I mean, it will be interesting to see exactly what this looks like. And I think that what sort of accommodations need to be made to this building will be really interesting, because again, this is to describe this area, it is an industrial area, historically
right.
industrial area. And
right.
So, you
not
know,
really residential, but there are people not. Around. It's not
yes.
like totally commercial. Like,
although it's just down the hill from Mission Hills. So I think some Mission Hills residents are going to have some things to say. One of the advantages of this, of course, as Gloria was emphasizing today, is yes, it's not surrounded by homes. So he's hoping that there will be less opposition. But of course, there are going to be people that are questioning this. And I will say, just to kind of drive home on those amenities that you're talking about, the city will have to pay for those and the city council will have to sign off on this plan. And we're staring down a big budget deficit. Interestingly, this is going to go to the Land Use and Housing Committee on April 18th. And that's just a few days after Mayor Gloria has to release his proposed budget. Mm. He's acknowledging he's going to have to make some tough choices there.
Mm-hmm. And so what does this mean for other city efforts on homelessness? Because I think we've seen the city try to diversify some of its options for homeless people. So from shelters to safe sleeping sites, maybe safe parking lots, extending those hours. But we've also heard, Mayor Gloria say in the past, like, San Diego can't be the only one picking up the slack, like other cities need to step up. And now they're here announcing a big warehouse, what does this mean? Like, are we still wanting other cities to step up? I know some other cities are talking about other homeless shelters.
Oh, absolutely he does. That's how he ended the press conference, in fact. What did he say? It would be really nice if other cities would also do things. And you reporters out there, you should be bugging them too. Don't just bug me. which is a common refrain for the mayor at this point. I will say there's a new shelter that's going to be opening up in National City this summer. Probably there are others across the county that, you know, regular readers of Voice of San Diego are probably hearing about some of these shelters, especially in North County, which Tiggis Lane has covered for us. As far as what this means for other projects in City of San Diego, I know I definitely went into this press conference wondering, what does this mean for H Barracks, which is this former public safety training facility that the city has near Liberty Station, where there's been a lot of controversy over some sort of proposal with details very much TBD of, you know, having some sort of shelter there. And they had talked about, you know, maybe sprung structures, maybe safe parking, maybe some safe camping there. And what Gloria came out and said today and preemptively said before any of us reporters there could ask is that the city still plans to move forward with H Barracks, but the plan that they're focused on now for the property is to do safe parking there, about 200 spaces. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think some of that, you know, they're really a lot more focused on people living in vehicles now because there's a new legal settlement that they have with people living in vehicles who were previously subject to enforcement, basically saying that they need to have places to offer people if they want to enforce the vehicle habitation ordinance. So there's a lot of focus right now on, you know, from the city perspective, making sure that they can do that. And that's also something that's a focus of this proposal, I would say, too, is that it increases the city's ability to enforce.
Also, though, this has the ability to tie into the camping ban, right? Because, you know, one of the most controversial things to happen around homelessness in the past year is that city council passed this camping ban where people can't camp in certain areas 24/7 and they can't camp in other areas when there's shelter available. So bringing online a 1,000-bed place might mean there's shelter available every day now. And so they can sweep everywhere every day now, right?
And that's, you know, that seems to be the case. So interestingly, Stephen Whitburn, council member who actually brought forward the camping ban, was just really emphasizing how much of a game changer this will be. You know, he kind of hinted at, yes, it gives the city more ability to sweep homeless camps. He also talked about and actually referenced my reporting on when I asked the question of, you know, Lisa, your reporting has shown that people are waiting for shelter beds and not getting them. And, you know, this has the ability to change that. Another option.
Fascinating.
So Lisa has also extensively covered homelessness and housing. And one of the most critical tools to combating this crisis is affordable housing. We're not talking about the chill landlord and the low rent. It's what some call capital A affordable housing. It's instrumental, some argue, in getting people off the street and alleviating the housing crisis. So Lisa, what the heck is affordable housing with a capital A?
So it's basically housing that has a lot of funding sources to make it happen, including government sources. And it generally serves people making up to 80% of the median income, which I did look up what that is currently. And for a family of four in San Diego, that would be about $110,000 a year. Now, most affordable housing serves people with much lower incomes, but that's sort of the barometer where someone starts to become eligible for affordable housing. And really, there is this industry that has built up around getting this subsidized housing to the finish line. It's the financing is super complex. You know, often they're seeking out things like tax credits, loans from the city or county, bond financing. It's really, really complicated.
Right. Because to build it, you got to have some way to pay for that building.
Well, and it's so complex that I'll name our former friend Andy Keats. I guess he's still our friend, still but our he just friend. He doesn't work at Voice anymore.
Former co-host.
But back when Andy was my editor at Voice of San Diego, I was working on a story about affordable housing projects, and he said, gosh, it's like a game of Jenga. And I have just stolen that phrase from him for years, because really that's what the financing looks like for affordable housing. They're really trying to assemble, you know, financing that can make one of these projects pencil. And if you pull one thing out, it can complicate everything else. And as I've learned more recently, a lot of these different funding sources can come with different requirements or incentives that can also increase the cost of the project.
When there's different tiers, right? You kind of mentioned it earlier, but there's affordable housing for those people with 80%, and there's affordable housing for people with almost no percent of the median income. Like, so there's like bands, and if you meet the band, then you get to stay in the housing. Is that right?
Yes. And also, you know, for people that are formerly homeless, sometimes, you know, there might be permanent supportive housing that comes with more services, and that can mean more costs.
And that's also under capital A affordable housing.
Yes.
So you might, on the one extreme end, you might have a permanent supportive housing for somebody who'd been homeless, who's paying nothing or almost nothing for that housing. And on the other end, you might have somebody who's like low, who meets that 80% figure of $110,000 for a family of four, and they get a different kind of unit that they actually are paying some money for. All of that's under the umbrella of affordable housing.
Yes. And there are working people that have affordable housing.
Right. So it's for working people, and it's for people also who've dealt with, you know, serious mental health issues or other things.
And I think for your story, so we've all seen the headlines every so often, right? There's an affordable housing project and it's going to get built and it's going to be X amount per unit. And sometimes those numbers are pretty big. And I think that's what kind of, you know, led to this story, right? We had you look at which are the five most expensive affordable housing projects. And what did you find? What were some of those, you know, factors that were increasing costs for these affordable housing projects?
So definitely, like I talked about before, these different funding sources and agencies that are funding these projects or helping to fund them often set these requirements. So for example, one that came up often was prevailing wage, or also for one of the projects, a project labor agreement. Now, I think, you know, many of our listeners would think that these are great things because they're increasing the wages of workers, and we need workers to be paid livable wages, right? And the developers would say so too. But the thing is that these things increase the cost.
Yeah.
So, for example,
let's build the Jenga tower for one of these.
Yeah. So you want to talk about one
of them? Let's put the
blocks. Okay. Yeah. Let's talk about why don't we talk about Affirm's project, which had this, both the PLA on it and the project labor agreement. So this is a 100 unit affordable housing project in Rancho Bernardo.
Okay.
That is at an MTS bus stop. It's called the Skyline Apartments, and this one got some attention because our pal Andy recently wrote about this one as well. I went and checked into this. Actually, the per unit cost went up a bit since he last looked at it. It's now at about $911,000 per unit.
So per unit.
So that means it costs $911,000 to build one unit of this 100-unit complex.
Yes and no.
Okay.
So yes, because that's the cost per unit. However, this is paying for a lot more than just the actual construction.
Okay.
So let's unpack that a bit. So for one, we talked about the wages associated with this project labor agreement and prevailing wages. That added about $17 million to the cost of this project, according to Affirm's estimates. So another thing that increased the cost here was that they had an arrangement with MTS, which actually owns the property that they're going to develop on. And MTS wanted them to replace parking spots at this bus stop. So that's 85 parking spots. And that added about $4 million to the cost of the project. Now, I know most people don't think parking's that expensive. I'm here to tell you, parking is really actually very expensive to build.
So on the parking versus the wages thing, When you say the project labor agreement added $17 million, is that on top of what the wages would have been otherwise, or is that just the cost of what the wages were?
So collectively, those two things, according to Affirmed, add 30% to the cost of their project. So it's you would have, you know, general wages that you would pay or that what they might see as standard, and then those things added 30%. Approximately.
Got it. So the wages added 30% more than it would have. And then you had $4 million on the parking lot.
Didn't $4 million on that.
Didn't mean to interrupt your flow there.
So the other thing that added cost is they decided to do commercial space, which was their call. They actually, you know, Affirmed wants to use that as their headquarters. Well, that added about $5 million to the cost of the project that is clearly not residential construction. And then, you know, a lot of times these sites need some upgrades to accommodate, you know, new people living there, right? So they needed to do some water and sewer upgrades. There were some landslide issues in that area in the past. So that tacked on another $4 million. So if we take a step back, you know, we talked about $911,000 a unit. A lot of those things aren't actually the units, right? And that is something that I saw in multiple projects that I looked at, is that, you know, we're so focused often in these stories with, you know, the eye-popping numbers on this per unit cost. But a lot of times these projects are paying for things above and beyond just the construction.
The labor. But yeah, beyond the wood and whatever. Mm-hmm. It's the labor, the parking they need to replace.
Yeah. And I think it's worth saying, too, like the actual projects themselves, too, the construction, the materials, all of that have been increasing quite a bit too. So these things are happening at the same time. You know, their costs are increasing for like just actually doing the units, like just let's just construct the affordable unit. But then there are all these other things on top of it. And those have been, you know, seemingly increasing over the years too.
So this one was $911,000 per unit to build. Do we know how much it might have been otherwise, or what is the average cost to build a unit in San Diego?
So if I'm remembering correctly, looking at the pipeline projects that the Housing Commission has reviewed in some way, the new construction projects were coming in at about $574,000 a unit in recent history, the ones that they've been looking at.
Affordable housing projects.
And these I called out specifically because they were substantially above that. And so I wanted to know what's going on. And these are the ones that make the headlines. Like at this point, you know, as 10 years ago, if we were talking about, you know, a project that cost $574,000 a unit, you know, people would have seen red. Mm-hmm. But now this is becoming, this is more of a normal number. And now we're focused on ones that cost almost a million dollars a unit.
And so what does this mean for affordable housing developers? Like, does this make them want to build stuff?
So, yeah, I think a lot of times there's a lot of, you know, folks that were bringing up when we were talking about these projects, like, you know, we don't want our projects to cost this much. This mm-hmm. isn't good for us because, for one, it looks bad. Mm-hmm. Two, you know, every time the cost goes up substantially, you need to find another funding source to help pay for it. And whether that's another loan or, you know, another like sort of financing engine, like that could come with another set of requirements that also increase your cost.
Right. Oh, we secured this loan, but now we got to like put in planters.
Yeah.
Or something.
Or even just like something as simple. One of the other projects I looked at, they put down $4.9 million or so to purchase land in City Heights. And to do that, they needed a loan. Well, that loan added $1.5 million in interest cost. Mm-hmm. And the reason that the land costs were high there is actually it was mostly publicly owned property. Mm-hmm. And the entities that were selling wanted to get some money for their property.
Mm-hmm. I guess thinking about these two stories holistically is like the biggest thing happening in our region right now, right? We're talking about adding homeless shelter beds, and we're talking about government funded or help subsidized affordable housing, you know, and I think these two things strike at the heart of the housing issue, right? Because I think the best practice for a while now, right, at least from the federal level and for other advocates, is that like we need a housing first model. That's what people have wanted. They've wanted a housing first model, and that means building more of this affordable housing. But that's expensive. That's slow. People have seen a crisis on the streets that's shocked them. And so now we're to the point where we're talking about adding 1,000 beds in a congregate shelter. And I don't know if you've heard pushback yet already. And like the more progressive wing is starting to push back against that, right? But I think the stakes are that some of the uber progressives would be against the congregate shelter. Some of the uber conservatives are against the affordable housing because they, you know, they think we shouldn't be giving away housing or subsidizing housing. But these are the two things currently in our quiver to alleviate homelessness.
Well, and I think, you know, your point is really important because I think they are extremely connected. So whenever I hear about a new shelter opening up, my immediate thought is, what's your housing plan? Because a shelter can't be successful unless there are places for people to go after it. Otherwise, they're essentially living in the shelter.
Right.
And I don't know about you, if you've gone to or walked by any of these shelters, they're not great places to live long term. They're designed to be places where people could land for a short period of time and then get assistance and then move on. And that's become increasingly difficult because of this huge gap and shortfall that we have of affordable housing options, whether that's affordable with a capital A, like you talked about, subsidized, or naturally affordable units, which, you know, for many years, you know, was a lot more predominant in San Diego than it is now. But a lot of redevelopment and just the nature of our market is just—
we've lost those.
Yes,
exactly.
We've lost them.
The Priebus Foundation owned 5,000 units or something, many of them naturally occurring affordable units. Blackstone has bought those units. Some of them, the rent is moving up. And what I've heard is that, you know, those naturally occurring units are dwindling there. I mean, they're dwindling everywhere.
Yes, they absolutely are. And all of those units are crucial to addressing homelessness,
right?
Because not everybody is going to qualify for one of these subsidized units. And obviously they're super complicated to get to the finish line and super expensive too.
Right, right, right. And we know that like what increases, you know, research shows that what increases homelessness is a housing crisis. It's not drug addiction, you know, because we've heard that from the left and the right, that it's not a homeless problem, it's a drug addiction problem. But you know, the highest drug addiction rates are in West Virginia. They're not in San Diego. And West Virginia doesn't have a homelessness problem because it has a lot of naturally occurring affordable housing, which is something we don't have. We have very expensive housing and we have very few open units. So it's hard to get an apartment here.
Real hard to get an apartment, especially if you're already unsheltered.
Yeah. Well, you can follow Lisa's stories and her reporting at VOSD.org/Lisa. That's VOSD.org/Lisa.
Thanks, Lisa.
You're welcome.
Good job, everybody.
I did okay.
Yeah, you did great.
We're going to take a quick break. Stay with us.
Are you passionate about resolving conflicts and making positive impact in the world? Then USD's Conflict Management and Resolution Master's Program may be for you. Learn to address conflicts at all levels, from personal disputes to global crises. Join the Kroc School's dedicated community fostering peace and understanding while you acquire practical skills to navigate diverse settings. Apply now and be the change you want to see in the world. Visit sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD. That's sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD. Join culture creator Ramel Wallace, museum CEO Micah Parzon, philanthropist Erwin Jacobs, and urban agriculturist Diane Moss on Season 2 of Stop and Talk, a podcast about the future of the San Diego region. How can we create a vibrant region that celebrates our cultural richness and economic strength? Find out and hear other San Diego experts on Stop and Talk. Discover seasons 1 and 2 now at stopandtalkpodcast.com. That's stopandtalkpodcast.com.
Will, we've got you on the show this week, not just for your Southern charm.
Charm.
And hot takes.
Yeah, charm, Jacob.
Charm.
Yeah, I'm trying to swallow that one.
But you had a story this week, and I think everyone should definitely take some time and read it. It'll be a long read, but it's definitely worth it. It's about mental health, romance, and a young, highly intelligent person who got stuck in the machine of the U.S. Navy, and she lost her way. Her name was Tierra Gray, and like a lot of folks, she was brought to San Diego because of her work with the Navy. So, Will, where does her story start?
Tierra's story starts in Cumberland, Maryland, which is kind of in a place of Maryland I never think about. It's on the far western end, like actually in the Appalachian Mountains above West Virginia. And Tierra really loved it there. It really spoke to her. You know, she like loved nature and animals and, you know, the rivers and the air and just being there. But it also is not a place of great opportunity, Cumberland, Maryland. As I put in the story, I think McDonald's, a federal prison, and Walmart are like some of the biggest employers. So it's not a place where it's like easy to get your life up off the ground, you know, if you're trying to achieve ambitious things. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Tierra was a art student. She was like into knitting and making teas and scarves, and you know, she wore these like big glasses and stuff, and no one really thought she was like going to go into the Navy. No one guessed that about her at all, but she happened to score really, really highly on the ASVAB, aptitude test for the military, one of the high scores at her high school that had ever been achieved, her teachers told me. And so when that happened, you know, the possibilities really changed for her, because she didn't know how she was going to pay for college. That was kind of the plan, go to college, but like, don't know how I'm going to pay for it. Mm-hmm. Going to go to college nearby, so I'm not really going to leave the area. Even though she loved the area, the idea of like getting out of the area for a while also sounded nice.
Right.
Free travel sounded nice. You know, her siblings really looked up to her, and she felt like it was like a responsible decision she could make that they would really be able to look up to. So she ended up signing a contract to go to nuclear power school in the Navy, which is one of the most like rigorous fields in the Navy you can go into.
It seems like the military is kind of an escape chute for a lot of folks in that area.
Definitely, definitely. You know, since going back since forever, right? Mm-hmm. You know, if you're from a place with not a lot of opportunity, the military is like a kind of just like an immediate button you can press that can potentially, you know, raise you up some economic levels, which mm-hmm. can be a difficult thing in this country and a lot of countries.
Or bring you to new places.
Totally.
Travel, meet new people, experience new things that you may not have experienced staying where you're from.
Exactly. And she's this smart person, and like all of a sudden now she can study nuclear power instead of work at like a restaurant and like a grocery store.
Mm-hmm. And so she scored high, and that made her, you know, someone that the Navy would want to recruit. But what was she sort of not showing them throughout this application process?
Yeah. She had struggled with her mental health, and, you know, her art teacher talked to me about that. They were really close. Her name was Sandy Arnold, and you know, she was worried about Tierra going into the Navy from the start because she had seen that she could just get really down sometimes, you know, and she would really, like, wear her emotions on her sleeve. Like, if she was down, like, you knew she was down. Mm-hmm. She was kind of shut off. And, you know, so she had been to see a psychiatrist, And that psychiatrist had considered diagnosing her with borderline personality disorder, but held off because you need to kind of see somebody for a long time or for a while to diagnose that. And, you know, she had also harmed herself at times, you know, when she felt really bad. It was like something that gave her release. And so I think these things would have been red flags in her if she had acknowledged them, but she did not. And you know, and that's a common thing in the military too, right? That people will gloss over certain facts to get in, and recruiters help them do that. Let's not make any bones about it. You know, I quoted a Military Times story where a recruiter was, Army recruiter is like, what it takes to get into the Army is a lot of fraud and perjury.
Yeah. And why is that? What was the reason that they, you know, say that there's a lot of this that you're seeing?
Well, recruitment has fallen a lot in recent years. You know, and around 9/11, there was like a boom in recruitment, and that boom has big time fallen off. It started falling off in other services sooner, like the Army, but it's hit the Navy now. It's hit all the service branches. And so now there's a real incentive to like get people through the door, get all the tiers through the door. Like anyone who's coming to visit your office as a recruiter, like recruit them. And then once they're in, we need to keep them in because the U.S. government has all these ideas about how many people we need in each of these service branches to keep them running, and we're not hitting those marks.
And so she joins the Navy. She's in this really hardcore program.
Goose Creek, South Carolina. That's where the nuclear power school is. Scott has lived there actually briefly because his wife was in the nuclear school.
R.I.P.
Who is that guy?
I don't know. It's a vague memory. Anyway, yeah, she goes to Goose Creek and she's in power school for a while, but it starts to get really stressful. It starts to really like awaken this serious anxiety in her. And she's in there for like 6 months, but then she calls her mom. She's like, I don't think I can do this anymore. And her mom's like, we don't need to keep doing it if you can't do it anymore. She goes to see a therapist. She fills out all these questionnaires on her depression and anxiety. And, you know, she's having like severe anxiety and depression symptoms every single day. And so the therapist is like really worried, disqualifies her from nuclear power school on the spot, and diagnoses her with adjustment disorder, which is where you're not like adjusting to a new environment, in this case, the Navy. And she goes to a transfer station, which is like kind of a holding station for people who they don't know where they're going in the Navy.
Yeah, it seemed like this strange purgatory. You described it as kind of like this island of misfit toys.
Yes, yeah. Someone who Tierra meets there, Dylan Seaman, who she ended up dating, who factors in the story quite a lot. He described it as the land of misfit toys to me. You know, people with injuries, people who maybe gotten in some trouble, you know, people who have fallen out of their field that they were in, like Tierra, all these people. You got 100, 200 people who are just kind of like doing odd jobs around the base, you know. And that's how she met Dylan, was they both were like cleaning patrol boats on the harbor and just spending a lot of time doing nothing mainly and like hanging out, smoking cigarettes. And so she meets him. She dates him for a while. Things start to look up, actually, you know, on those questionnaires. Her depression, anxiety is improving. Her therapist says she's fit to proceed into the conventional Navy. And that's when she becomes a machinist mate, a person who works on ships and ships out to San Diego.
You know, one of the most interesting pieces about this story was just how relatable Tierra felt to me. You know, I feel like I've met her or people like her, you know, the sensitive artist. I was that myself for many years. And, you know, your description of how she spent her time in San Diego was so fascinating too, because I feel like at any moment I could have run across her. You know, she and Dylan, and even she by herself would, you know, lay on the beach at Sunset Cliffs at night. She would go write in her diary at Lestat. She went to punk shows, went to a show at Soma that I had to literally check to see if I'd played, because I was playing in bands at the time and we'd played shows like that. And so it was fascinating to kind of imagine this city and imagine the ways in which she had existed simultaneously in all these different places. I mean, what was it like having access to her diaries and kind of getting that insight into the kind of person that she was and the way that she moved about San Diego?
Yeah. You know, I don't want to make it about me, but it affected me quite a lot. I mean, just in how vivid it was.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not trying she's to say great, how hard it was.
She was a very, very vivid. Honest writer too, right?
She's mm-hmm. like a very honest writer. She's like bearing her soul in this journal, which I used to help me write the story. And, you know, and yeah, and she's just going to all these places you've been, right?
Yeah.
To Lestat's in Normal Heights, a place so many people have like gone and written in their journal, right?
Yeah.
Which is like something that she loved to do. And yeah, and you get a sense of her sensitivity. You get a sense of how much she is really trying to work through the stuff she's struggling with. You know,
yeah.
she's struggling with depression. She's struggling with like how she sees herself and who she is in the world, and to see and feel somebody like writing so honestly about that. Yeah. It really hit home for me too. Right. And I think it does for a lot of people to like really just struggle to find your place in the world is something we all go through to some extent.
Yeah. She was having these experiences that so many 19, 20, 21 year old people have, but with the added pressure of being in the Navy. Yeah.
Exactly.
And so she's now in San Diego and she's on a ship. Which ship was she assigned to and what was she doing exactly?
The USS Essex, which is a very big ship. It's not a aircraft carrier, but it's an amphibious assault ship. They're quite big. They're designed to launch helicopters, but they can launch F-35B jets as well. Its nickname is the USS Depressix. That's what she knew it as. I've since seen people call it the Stressix as well. And yeah.
And is that because the ship was just a powder keg of anxiety? I mean, what was kind of behind that nickname?
I think, you know, I've heard that different ships have different cultures.
Mm.
And it's not just all one thing. And, you know, one thing I've heard is that some of the older ships seem to have some of the worst cultures, frankly, you know, mm-hmm. more where it's just like a pressure cooker, where it's just kind of like get it done at all cost situation. And so there is a lot of work to be done and there can be a lot of stress on the ship. Right. And,
yeah.
And she, you know, at times she's working like 12-hour days and then she's like standing 6 hours of watch at night when she's on the ship, you know?
Jesus.
And yeah. And so when she starts going, the ship, when she gets to San Diego is in a maintenance period. And so that means it's kind of at the dock. And so these ships, they'll go through maintenance, then they'll go through a workup, then they'll go on deployment. And the workup phase is when they're going on underways and training a lot. So they'll leave San Diego for a day or 2 weeks or 3 weeks at a time, prep all their systems, teach you how to do these drills of how you'd unload hovercrafts and like helos and like, you know, do an actual like beach assault that mm-hmm. these things can facilitate. And all the other types of missions they might do, humanitarian missions as well. And so when the maintenance period's okay, you know, in some ways, but Tyrus kind of starts drinking a lot. She
yeah,
starts,
how's her like mental state at this moment?
Yeah. Yeah. She improved, for a while, you know, once she got out of nuclear power school. Then she starts drinking pretty heavily, you know, and it sounds in her journal and from the people I've talked to, like she was doing that to fit in to a certain extent. You know, mm-hmm. it's a pretty,
yeah.
pretty big drinking culture in the Navy and certainly with the people around her. And, you know, that could help her with her depression, anxiety at times. It was helping her fit in, but also it was kind of just shoving that stuff down a little mm-hmm. bit. And then the ship starts going underway more. And then
can you define underway?
Sure. It starts going underway for like a day or two at a time to just start training off the coast. And so everyone who's assigned to the ship is on the ship.
And that basically just means going out to sea and performing trainings and whatnot.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And so those underways then get really stressful, and mm-hmm. she starts thinking about suicide a fair amount. Mm-hmm. And like thinking about her only way off the ship. And that led her to reveal to some people she was not well, reveal to Dylan, you know, who she was dating at the time, that she was not well. And after that, she ends up getting hospitalized a couple times.
Mm-hmm. So she shares with Dylan, her partner, that she's not doing well. But how does this work when you're in the military? Like, who do you tell, hey, I'm not in a good place, and what do they have to do after that?
Yeah, well, you can go to a few different places. And the first place Tierra went was the ship's medical department. We don't know exactly what happened in that interaction, but she told people that it wasn't very helpful. So then she goes back to her direct supervisor, a petty officer first class. She was a second class machinist mate. So she goes to her first class, and they send her to what's called Fleet and Family Services, mm-hmm. which is a place for counseling in the Navy, all types of counseling, financial counseling, relationship counseling, counseling if you're feeling suicidal. And so they take her to the emergency room of Naval Medical Center, which is a huge naval hospital here in San Diego in Balboa Park. And she goes to a psychiatric care ward, a locked ward called One North. And there, you know, they begin that, you know, she's seeing psychiatrists who are trying to diagnose what's going on with her. And they diagnose her to begin with major depressive disorder and alcohol use disorder. And they mark her as not fit for duty. But mm-hmm. that doesn't mean she's out of the Navy, but they mark her as not fit for duty.
Mm-hmm.
Next, they send her to inpatient rehab program, which is SARP is the acronym. So they send her to SARP for 35 days. She wasn't too convinced on it because it's mostly for alcohol stuff and drug mm-hmm. stuff. And she like wasn't so sure that was what she needed. Turns out the program is actually a lot broader than that. It deals with overcoming depression and all these other things. And she actually kind of got into it, you know, mm-hmm. and felt like she was learning stuff from it. But then like 5-7 days before she gets out, and I feel like this is like such a cry for help, you know, she harms herself while she's there.
Mm-hmm.
And she tells her counselor about it. It was not a suicide attempt, but she's like self-harming. She tells her counselor, they take her back to Naval Medical Center, back to One North. They hospitalize her for 2 days. She's not really honest with them about, I mean, was she, you can see in the notes her going back and forth between how honest to be with them about whether it was a real suicide attempt. They're asking her if it was a suicide attempt. And she's saying like, well, if I tell you it was a suicide attempt, like, I know you're going to keep me here longer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know? And then you see that in the notes a lot, like that she's, you know, really friendly with these nurses and stuff, and joking a little bit about what is a very dark situation, obviously.
And that's one thing that's unique and I found really interesting in your story, that when it comes to individuals who may need, you know, some sort of mental health help, the person seeing you kind of has two masters, right? Not like if I'm an individual who maybe is getting some help because I'm going through something, that doctor is not going to share my information with my boss,
right?
It's private between us too, but that's not how it works in the military.
No, not at all. And I didn't hit home with me until I started interviewing some former military psychologists. But, you know, if a service member is getting treatment from a psychologist and that psychologist is considering marking them not fit for duty or putting them on limited duty, which is an official term, then, you know, the commanding officers get to weigh in on all that stuff. They get to look at certain medical records. They might see what this person's dealing with, see what their treatment is, and be able to say to the psychologist, oh, well, like, I see she's depressed, but we also really need her, and I think she can push through. Mm-hmm. And you might have somebody saying this to a psychologist who they outrank, you know, mm-hmm. and while the psychologist might still technically have the ability to mark that person not fit for duty, you know, they can also very much like hear that as an order, right? Mm-hmm. Like, no,
we need this person.
Yeah, we need this person.
Like, you're gonna figure out to make them okay.
Yeah, so, and so they're considering the needs of the military as well as the person's mental health.
Mm-hmm. So she's going through, and maybe she's not being completely honest about this suicide attempt or non-suicide attempt. And so what happens at that point when she's kind of, you know, being looked at again?
This time in the hospital, they mark her as fit for light duty. Strangely, you know, her condition doesn't seem to have changed that much at this point, but that still carried the restriction that she should not go underway. Mm-hmm. Okay. First they said not fit for duty. That means you're not supposed to be doing anything. Then they say fit for light duty, but no underways, not supposed to carry a firearm. She goes back to SARP to finish out her 35 days. She's back there 5 days or so. They release her from SARP. The next day she goes to see a therapist who she only ever saw one time. Mm-hmm. And that therapist then marked her as fit for full duty.
So to be clear, somebody that she met once, even after these months and months of hospital visits, these months and months of, you know, rehab programs, these months and months of mental health struggles, one person who met Tierra Gray once was able to send her back on a ship.
Yeah, that's right. And there may be other providers backed up that decision along the way, but mm-hmm. not necessarily because they talked to each other. But yeah, the first person to mark her fit for full duty was the day after she left SARP, and it was somebody who saw her only that one time, despite the fact that she'd had a psychiatrist for a combined 11 days in the hospital who'd marked her not fit for duty. She'd seen countless other therapists at SARP. And that's one of the other big themes of the story, right? In less than a year during this heightened struggle for her, she sees more than 25 different therapists. The most she ever sees one is 6, 8, 10 times. She sees some once. She sees some 3 times, and they give her all these conflicting evaluations and reports. They seem to be working off different information, you know?
Yeah.
At one point, somebody diagnoses her with borderline personality disorder. That person only saw her 3 times. But okay, then it's in her file. Then it is on paper. She has borderline personality disorder. She also told somebody that she'd attempted suicide actually while she was in Goose Creek, South Carolina. And so then that's in her file. But some people are evaluating her for her suicide risk and checking that she doesn't have depression or checking that she doesn't have prior suicide attempts, and they're marking her as low risk. Other people are checking those boxes. They're marking her as high risk. You know, I'm not saying no doctors ever talk to each other in the course of all this, but there does not have seemed to have been like cohesive communication going on throughout, right? For sure.
Like, last time so-and-so saw you, okay, here's what they said, and mm-hmm. now I'm going to take that into consideration to my diagnosis.
So it, essentially throughout all of these visits, people aren't working on the same information. They aren't collaborating with each other or seems really communicating with each other very much at all. And all of those crossed wires lead to Tierra back on the Essex.
What happens then?
Yeah, she's back on. All these things do lead her back onto the ship. And now the workup phase is getting more intense. That's how workups are, as the name would indicate, right? You start going on longer and longer underways. You're mm-hmm. out at sea for longer periods. And so Tierra goes underway at least 8 different times over a 6-month period. You know, you see she's going to see therapists during this time. At one point she tells a therapist that, you know, I don't know if I can do this treatment that you want me to do because, like, my command needs a lot from me right now too. And the therapist, like, questions her on that. And the therapist says, you know, well, are you sure that it's that, or are you just like conflicted about going to more treatment yourself? Mm. And, you know, the therapist acknowledges that there was like a rupture with her and Tira at that time, and that there would have to be like trust rebuilt because they got into this friction over that. Right. Mm.
So even in that instance, Tiara was kind of doing what a lot of the psychologists and commanders that she'd seen before were doing, and kind of compromising what's best for her mental health with what's best for her ship.
And I think she went back and forth on it too. Mm-hmm. You know, I think she in some ways, yes, she's probably compromising for the needs of the ship and for what her command has told her. That's what she told her therapist that day. Mm-hmm. But she's also wanting to push through, you know, and you see this in the journal. You see her wanting to push through, but then you see other places where she has like a list in her journal of things I should do but don't act on. And the first one is like, you know, get out of the Navy.
Yeah.
So it's a very, very stressful time for her as these underways kick back in. Obviously, all these therapists and doctors had acknowledged that the underways were a source of a triggering thing on her anxiety and depression, and that they exacerbated these things. And so during these eight underways, it's, you know, you see she's having good days, she's having bad days, but there's a deterioration going on.
And how did those who worked with her speak of her during this period?
Everyone who worked with her knew that she was going through stuff and that she was going to therapy. She would write in her journal sometimes, and they would call it Gray's time. You know, like they would let her step out of the workflow at times to actually do that. So, you know, people know about it. She's a good worker. You know, she's promoted from third class to second class, which was not something that, you know, needed to happen. You know, she's promoted quicker than she could have been. Mm-hmm. She's put in charge of a shop, the aft shop, that's like in charge of like hydraulics on the Essex. So, you know, she's known as a good worker who's also struggling and sometimes
and
needs
she
some
also
breaks.
Has responsibilities.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And you know, there's different interviews in the files I have with people, and you know, one person who was in charge of her talks about like told another person, oh, I have to be careful when I yell at her, like, because mm-hmm. we know how it is, you know. And somebody else talked about like the chain of command liking to make examples of people, right? Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. Tiara tells some of her therapists like that, you know, being on the ship is hard because people don't say the nicest things, right? And so there are these little pieces of information where, you know, we see that it's like a bit of a pressure cooker for her because of these events that are happening. And because when you're on that ship, you can't get off that ship. You can't go home. She can't go be with Dylan, you know, who's mm-hmm. a source of like comfort and reassurance to her. She's just stuck there, period.
So what happens?
So 6 months, 7 months after she gets out of the hospital for the last time and the SARP for the last time, she's on at least her eighth underway. She goes to the ship's medical department. She's telling them she's having panic attack like symptoms, shortness of breath, chest tightness. They acknowledge she's diagnosed with borderline personality disorder, something, by the way, that other military therapists have told me should have been an automatic disqualifier from mm-hmm. her going underway mm-hmm. because it's such a severe disorder. The ship's medical department notes these things, but says we're going to check back in with her a couple days later. She ends up taking her own life on board the Essex on April 2nd, 2018.
You know, one of the heartbreaking things about Tiara's journal entries is that she paints out throughout them this alternate route that she could have taken. There was another kind of life on the other side of the life that she ended up living, and it's truly heartbreaking to hear her describe that in her own words, because it's you can see just how deeply, you know, she wasn't right for the Navy and wasn't right for the military. And I would love if we could kind of end this on an entry of hers that kind of paints out what that life was. So I'm going to read this journal entry from March 4th, 2018. This was 29 days before she passed. Write down your dream life in extreme detail. I'm back home. I live in a secluded wooded area in a tiny house. It's cozy and warm inside with a lot of antique furniture. There's a cozy reading nook for me in a garage for Dylan. I have a dog and they are my absolute best friend. They love me. The house is secluded but still within a reasonable distance of the rest of my family. I'm going to college to learn and be more well-rounded. No particulars in mind. I work full-time at the animal shelter working with dogs. I get to come home every day to the love of my life. We own everything and have zero debt. We have a nice savings account that could support us if anything happened. We have the money to travel regularly and we see the world. We get to spend a lot of time in nature, hiking, camping, and stargazing. I have quit drinking, smoking for good. I'm still a vegetarian and cook a lot of healthy, hearty, homemade meals. That's what an ideal future looks like for me. Nature, family, learning, growing, doing something I love for work with enough spare time to create. I think the reason I put the dream out of my head for so long is because everyone told me I could do whatever I wanted, that I could be a lawyer, doctor, etc. So I felt like I had to aim high. Everyone complained that home sucked and was full of degenerates, so I felt like I had to leave or risk becoming trapped and becoming like them. I'm grateful for everything that's happened, though. Otherwise, I wouldn't have had these revelations.
Yeah, I mean, that one tears me up, you know, and that's how we ended the story. And I hadn't read it in a while. You know, I knew quite a bit earlier than when I finished the story that I wanted that to be the last thing that sat with people. And, you know, so to hear it read out loud is just, you know, it's a lot to know that Tira still could have been here. She still could have, like, lived that life. But, you know, clearly her treatment in the military, you know, if it did not cause her death, it certainly extremely exacerbated the circumstances that caused her to die. And that's what other people have found, you know, mental health professionals when they've reviewed her files as well.
It seems like over and over, there were all of these routes that could have been taken by her doctors, by her commanders, and there was this systematic failure to keep her safe, to do what was right for her.
Yeah, exactly that.
You can read this full story and see Tierra's journal entries and pictures at vosd.org/will. It's vosd.org/will.
If you or someone you know might be considering suicide, there is help. Call or text 988, the Suicide Prevention and Mental Health Crisis Lifeline. You can also visit 988california.org.
Thanks for listening to the Voice of San Diego podcast, the most popular public affairs podcast in San Diego. Support our whole team and this podcast with a donation that will ensure our show and our journalists can keep doing great work to serve the region. Become a member now at vosd.org/give. That's vosd.org/give. I'm Andrea Lopez Villafana, managing editor at Voice of San Diego. Jacob McWinney is our education reporter and theme music composer. Will Huntsbury is senior investigative reporter. Nate John is our producer. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.